You have reached a number that has been changed or is no longer in service. Please check the number you dialed and try or call again. 67011.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. I'm Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Kyle, all the way on the other side of the room.
Yes.
Take your time. Out in Signalland, we have Alex.
You do indeed.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Well, it's been one of those weeks, hasn't it? You guys following the news? You follow the news at all? No.
I make an attempt sometimes.
There's been a lot of crypto news lately. Have you been following crypto news? Because it's a word I can't say, but it has to do with a bat, and it's kind of crazy. There was this incident in Manhattan involving this poor guy who was held captive in a neighborhood downtown by two people, actually maybe as many as three people, and there might have been other people coming and going. And basically it all boiled down to people who were in business together, and one person wanted the other person's quote-unquote Bitcoin password. Now, those of us who know anything about Bitcoin know that it's not really a Bitcoin password. It's how would you describe it, Alex? It's a different kind of a passphrase from a different kind of organization.
Yes, they were obviously looking to access the wallet that was holding the Bitcoin or whatever digital assets this person who was abducted. I may be getting ahead of the story here, but the person was obviously kidnapped and abducted and held unlawfully for some period of time with the purpose of extorting that individual so that they would provide a large number of bitcoins or other digital assets to the captors.
It's a bizarre story because of the way the media has been handling it. They treat the people very differently when they have money. Now, this guy was described, the main perpetrator was described as the Bitcoin King of Kentucky. And I'm not sure if that's a compliment or what exactly that is, but it's an interesting way to describe somebody. They talked about all these horrible things that were happening to the poor victim from Italy, and they would cap it off by saying, "But the perpetrator was known as a nice person. He was worth over $100 million, as if that is a measure of how nice somebody is, how much they're worth. I think we know that somebody can be worth an awful lot of money and still be a horrible, terrible, psychotic, insane individual. I'm just speculating, but I'm pretty sure we all know that. So anyway, these guys held this person captive. And here's another issue. It's got nothing to do with the story, really. But do you guys know the Nolita neighborhood? I've heard that phrase so many times. I swear I have never heard anybody describe that part of Manhattan as Nolita. I've heard it described as Little Italy. I've heard it described as Soho. It seems like this Nolita name is just being kind of pushed right now. I don't know. Is it a trendy thing or am I just out of it?
I think yes. You're out of it. I've been hearing it for years.
I've never heard you say it, Alex. I've never heard you say, hey, let's go to Nolita. Tell us what Nolita is for those who are ignorant like me.
I believe it stands for North of Little Italy, right? Is that right?
It does.
You can figure it out.
I know that now. You can figure it out. It's kind of pieced together like that. But why do we need another name? We have Little Italy. We have Soho. We have all kinds of. All right, whatever. I'm getting off the track.
Just think about how many syllables it is to say North of Little Italy.
I never had to say that.
Just say Nolita.
This happened on Spring Street, which goes through Little Italy. So you know. All right, you know, it doesn't matter. So this kind of a thing, though, where people are being abducted and held captive for a password, it kind of seems to be the theme of where we are now. Because whether you're at a border or whether you're in some person's apartment in a made-up part of town, it just seems like passphrases are what are being demanded of us. And, you know, obviously this victim did not have to give that information out, and he did not, and was able to escape, fortunately. Of course, people at borders, in our definition, do not have to give out that information. There's such a thing as privacy. But this whole thing with cryptocurrency, it's just, you know, it takes getting robbed to a different place. You know, before you'd have your pocket picked, you'd even have your bank account accessed through some kind of cybersecurity issue. But now, if you have knowledge in your head to some massive amount of money, which exists now because of cryptocurrency and how it's able to spike quickly and become worth. Bitcoin has doubled in value since Trump got elected, which is a crazy thing to acknowledge. And I don't know what it means, but with almost everything that comes out of this administration, I believe it's a scam. I believe that people are ripping off other people, and it's kind of not real. It's kind of vaporware. But this is the reality we live in now, where somebody just visiting another city can be tortured for a password to currency that only exist in the digital world. I don't know. I just feel like the world's making less and less sense. Alex, go ahead.
I mean, look, as somebody who works for the Ethereum name service, this is something that's constantly on our minds. I would disagree with you in that.
What is that on your mind? Torture or vaporware?
I disagree with the idea that digital assets are all vaporware. I know that's an unpopular opinion in some of these circles here, but digital assets have real value, they have real functions, and they are highly sought after, and that's why you see these kidnappings on the rise. This is a constant problem now.
Wait, how many times is this going on? People are being kidnapped constantly?
It's going on quite a lot. I mean, if you've been following the news here, I mean, just this year, there's been, I don't know, at least four or five of these kidnappings and extortionate type of ransom demands. Lots of these involve very severe physical violence as well. In fact, in January of this year, of 2025, one of the co-founders of a company called Ledger, who wasn't even with the company anymore, was abducted in Paris, I believe, and held hostage for a number of days, during which he actually was mutilated. And he had his finger severed and sent over to the company ledger to show that they had really meant business. He was eventually rescued, I believe, by the French authorities. But this has happened time and time again, and it's been happening for quite a few years now. And these kidnappings and these ransoms are on the rise. It's also not surprising to me in some ways as well, because if you think about these types of criminals and the opportunities that they have, you know, people still will go out and rob banks. It's an odd thing, but if you listen to the police scanner, you know, banks are still robbed in Manhattan and New York all the time. But you don't get away with that much money. When you rob a bank, you'll get away with, you know, maybe $20,000, $30,000. You're going to be on videotape. There's lots of security. You're probably going to get caught. It's like a really kind of desperate thing that you do, and you're not going to get millions of dollars. These aren't the bank heists that you would see. Whereas nowadays, if you focus on people that you know have a high number of digital assets that are worth a large value, or whether highly valued in fiat currency or real money that is not cryptocurrency, if you hold that person hostage and you force them to essentially open up their wallet and transfer those digital assets to you, you could be getting away with millions of dollars in quite literally seconds. That's how it works here. So it's really not surprising to me that we see these kidnappings on the rise. And in fact, in the United States last year, the Department of Justice had actually indicted a criminal enterprise of bad guys that were going around the country and breaking into people's homes, engaging in home invasions and unlawful imprisonment of people that were known to have large numbers of digital assets, high values of Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever other digital assets. And all of this money is trackable to individuals because it's on a public ledger system. This is what the blockchain is. There's full transparency about what happens on the blockchain. There are some blockchains like that are associated with currencies like Monero that are a bit more opaque and very, very difficult to trace. But it's quite easy to figure out, if you're not really careful about how you store your assets, where and who they might belong to. And that's why these kidnappings are on the rise, because these are high value targets. You can get away with that money really, really quickly. And then if you're smart about it, you would have sophisticated laundering techniques in place so that when the money hits your wallet, it quickly goes out and is laundered, and you can turn it into fiat currency in some other way. So these are sophisticated operations.
Is it the view of the cryptocurrency community that the onus is on the end user to be responsible for their own security? Because to me, this seems like a big security hole where you can just get a passphrase or a series of numbers from somebody and get instant access to their entire fortune, and there's nothing anybody can do about it.
You could do the same thing with a bank account as well.
FDIC kind of insures bank accounts. And like you said, robbing a bank, there's a big difference. Robbing a bank, like you said, you get caught. You're on video. Here, there's none of that. It just seems to me this is a massive problem, and it doesn't seem like anyone really is doing anything about it.
But let's say Rob has $10 million in his bank account, and I can access his bank account, and I'm not talking about going into the bank and accessing his bank account. I'm talking about accessing his bank account digitally. You know, I can transfer money out of his bank account in the same way. He may have some kind of FDIC insurance that would provide him compensation for the loss, but that would be really only if the bank itself was robbed. So it's just, I think, the fact that you can transfer so much money so quickly when it comes to digital assets that makes it an attractive target as opposed to banks. And of course, the onus is on the end user to account for their own physical security, because who else would do that, Emmanuel?
Oh, well, we're not just talking about physical security. We're talking about the security of their wallet. We're talking about using the right methods to make sure that, you know, your transactions aren't being hijacked or intercepted in some way. And I think that's a bit much to ask for people who don't have a lot of technical ability. Or are we just assuming that everybody engaged in this has to be an expert as well?
Well, you should understand how the technology works. You have to be very, very cognizant of scams. Scams are increasing. They're sophisticated. They're very realistic. AI systems are propelling the volume and velocity of these types of scams to make them even more realistic. But let's say you have an account on something like Coinbase or Bitstamp or, you know, one of these exchanges. They're obviously going to take extra special cautions to try to protect their users. But your users are going to be continually targeted. And because you may have information, like perhaps, let's say, I mean, and this is a really, really big problem, I think, that has happened right now. And I think it leads us to a very critical issue here with this show, which is that Coinbase was recently breached over the last couple of weeks, or at least we learned about this incident fairly recently. And part of that breach, as I understand it, was the information about customers and their private details, their addresses, their names, their phone numbers, their driver's licenses. I think that that's data that was part of this breach. And that's part of the KYC system that is to ensure that these cryptocurrency exchanges are not used for bad purposes like money laundering. So KYC standing for Know Your Customer requirements. So the federal government, as part of these banking regulations, is requiring these cryptocurrency exchanges to hold the private information of all of their users in their system and verify that information through their KYC processes, through their Know Your Customer processes. If that data is not held securely, as it does not seem to have been in many ways, perhaps with Coinbase recently, that now raises a massive amount of what used to be just digital security issues, but now are resulting in potentially physical security threats to holders of digital assets. That's really serious. It's really dangerous, and it's not going to end well.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, this brings to light why I think one of the reasons I've always been really dubious about cryptocurrency. I mean, money itself has basically been digital since far before cryptocurrency became a thing. 33 years ago now, the movie Sneakers was telling us about how it's all just data now. It's all ones and zeros. And that was true. But there was also accountability built into the system. The FDIC, the world's banks and treasuries and credit companies and everything were tracking where all the digital virtual money was going. So if you were robbed or if you were the victim or the perpetrator of something like this, people could look back on the records and track this stuff down to a degree. And then cryptocurrency came out, and I think like a certain crowd were really excited about it because, like, let's decouple it from all that. Let's take tokens of exchange currency and bring it back to the individual to wrangle, and let's have blockchains and all this distributed stuff, which was interesting in concept, but in practice it becomes something like this, where it's not just the government or the bank that has your info, it's everybody. And that's going to put the physical security of people who are known to have a lot of these video game points in their pocket. It's really, I don't think it's a positive development. And, I don't actually have $10 million in my bank account, but what little I do scrape together, I think will never, as far as I can control it, be involved in any of this, because I do not want to be in the Wild West again. I do not want to be in the ancient societies where, you know, you had to carry around chunks of actual gold and you're always going to be at risk of having, you know, getting knocked over the head and having your bag of gold taken away from you.
Well, you know, I'll admit it's good for people who invest a little bit and see a good return. But I would advise anyone who is embarking on something like this, never invest more than you can afford to lose. It is very much like gambling. It really is, because things can go haywire at a moment's notice, or things can double and triple at a moment's notice. That's when I say it doesn't feel real, because that's not generally how the world works as far as appreciation of value of anything. So this is something that, you know, we're all learning about, but, you know, my concern is that we're not really paying attention to the dangers as much as we should. And when you have situations like what happened in Manhattan last week, it just points to, Alex said, a really serious issue that apparently is happening all around the world, and that needs to be dealt with. Did you have anything else, Alex? Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more. And I think that the, but I disagree with the characterization of all of this just being related to gambling. I think there are very real life reasons why holders of digital assets would want to hold certain assets. You know, there are tokens that have governance functions associated with them, especially with respect to Ethereum as opposed to Bitcoin. Bitcoin is really just about the value of the Bitcoin itself. That is more akin, I think, to gambling, although it does have its use cases for transactions and other things. But Ethereum is a system, Ethereum is a blockchain system that allows for smart contracts and interactivity on that particular blockchain. What we're doing within ENS also has a lot to do with the protection of user privacy and establishing user sovereignty over your own data, protecting your own data, making sure things are private, making sure things are trustless, making sure things are permissionless and out there and open and accessible. We're, a lot of what's being built right now on the basis of blockchains is the vision of the internet before it was corrupted by surveillance capitalism. So I don't think that we should discount this entire world as being just a world of degenerate gamblers. It certainly has that aspect to it. And I think if you go back to 2016, 2017, in the world of these initial coin offerings, there were a lot of scams and a lot of people lost a lot of money. But we certainly evolved from that. And I like to think that we're on a right direction and trying to course correct where the internet is going and where it's been. Like, we're trying to learn from our mistakes in terms of what we let happen to our data and what we let happen to the internet. And we're doing that on various blockchains.
Well, I'd like to see it just become more secure as far as people being able to transfer money without fear that something is going to intercept their transactions, which happens quite a bit. I you know, people should not feel fear about having knowledge in their head that can be very much desirable, because, you know, how this poor guy, how does he escape that? You know, you can leave your bank card at home, you can leave your login information somewhere else, but if your Bitcoin accessing whatever you use, if that's something that is always within reach and people know that you have it, it just seems like you're never safe. You know, as long as you have that connection, you're never safe. And a lot of people don't seem to. For instance, I admit I'm not an expert on this. I don't have time to be an expert on this. But Alex, perhaps you can tell me, when there's a wallet out there, digital wallet out there, it's possible for anybody to look at that wallet and see what kinds of transactions have been made with that wallet. Is that correct?
Not necessarily. It depends on how the wallet is configured.
Okay.
In certain ways, right? So, you know, certain transactions may be traceable only back to an exchange, and then the exchange-hosted wallets might be more difficult to figure out who's doing what with that. So if you're on some kind of centralized exchange like Coinbase, it might be more difficult to track.
But if you have your own wallet ID and you're not going through an exchange, as many people did, especially in the early days, I was told it was possible with that ID to see all the transactions. You don't know what they're for. You don't know the name of the person. But if you know that this person has this wallet ID, which you would if they gave it to you to give them money or something, you would then be able to see all the transactions that they had with other IDs. You still wouldn't know who they were, but you would know if the person was transferring lots of money. And to me, that's a flagrant violation of privacy. But it's the norm in this world, and that's what bugs me.
Well, it's a public ledger system on a blockchain. That's what a blockchain really is. It's like a public ledger. If you think about Ethereum itself, right? It's like a gigantic spreadsheet operated by a computer that can never be turned off, right? You know, our dear friend Virgil had, you know, when I got into this world, he had described Ethereum to me as trying to solve some of the world's most boring problems, right? If you think about the problems that you can solve with a spreadsheet that exists across the entire globe, those are the problems that Ethereum can solve. And you can do a hell of a lot with that. And it's quite interesting and fascinating to see what builders are building these days. And there's a lot of that going on. But by virtue of it being a public ledger system, there is not a lot of financial privacy attendant to those particular transactions. But what it does allow you to do is have trust with the people with whom you are engaging and transacting, and knowing that, you know, the source of their funds was somewhat legitimate. It came or originated from someplace that you know you can track and trace all of this. But when you do try to engage in some kind of technological measure of financial privacy, you know, mixing your currency or routing it through something like Tornado Cash, well, then the government doesn't like that because they want to see where all your transactions are. Because and starting in the Southern District of New York in this July, we have the prosecution of the developers, the software developers of Tornado Cash, which was an Ethereum-based cryptocurrency mixing system that enabled financial privacy on the Ethereum blockchain. So, you know, it's hard to, for us to, I think, have it both ways in this sense.
Well, I got to tell you, just the concept of me using something called Tornado Cash, I'm supposed to feel serious about this. It just seems really wacky. And, you know, I love it. I love the chaos. I do. But I just have to warn people, be careful what you're getting into, because it might not be what you think it is. And that's I'll leave it at that. But let's move on to another crypto story, because, boy, there were a bunch of crypto things that happened. Of course, I'm talking about Donald Trump's insane $148 million meme coin dinner. You guys heard about this, right?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Did any of you go to this? Stop chortling, no. Rob. Rob's just giggling, but you're not answering. No? Yeah? All right. I didn't.
I missed that. I was washing my hair.
Well, it was a black tie gala at his Virginia Golf Club, and it's for the biggest buyers of Trump's coin. The top 25 wallets, because that's how you refer to people these days. The top 25 wallets were promised a private reception and guided tour. There were 220 attendees. Amongst them were crypto influencers. I got to say, by default, if you're a crypto influencer, I don't think I like you just because of that label. Industry executives such as Sandy Carter of Unstoppable Domains and former NBA star Lamar Odom, who used the occasion to praise Trump as the greatest president and promote his own token, Odom dollars or whatever. It's all just so sleazy. My God. Anyway, 25-year-old Nicholas Pinto, whose dad drove him to the event in his Lamborghini, left underwhelmed and still hungry. And, you know, I feel for you. I feel for you, Nicholas Pinto. He said the food sucked. Wasn't giving any drinks other than water or Trump's wine. I don't drink, so I had water. My glass was only filled once. Trump made only a brief appearance, Pinto said. He didn't talk to any of the 220 guests, maybe the top 25, which is exactly what the story reports. Yes, the top 25 wallets. All in all, Trump was there for 23 minutes. He delivered a brief address, rehashing old crypto talking points, then left on a helicopter before taking any questions or pictures with his meme coin contest winners. Phones were not locked in RFID pouches, and security was lax, according to Pinto. Once Trump left, they didn't really care about anything else. I don't know. things like this really make me wonder just where we're heading. You combine cryptocurrency with the most corrupt president in history. Where is that going to go? You know? I don't think it's good for the industry. Does anyone? Gila?
I don't think it's good for anyone or anything. And I was reading something about the gentleman who was tortured in Nolita, which, by the way, side note, there's a book I read as a kid. I learned the term Nolita from a book from the late 70s. And you know, it's not like you're going to say, oh, it's that house. It's in Nolita. It sounds fancy. It's not new. But that the Trump media organization has announced some kind of plan to raise $1.5 billion by selling shares of the organization and converting that into cryptocurrency. Maybe specifically Bitcoin. I'm not 100% sure. I fail to understand how this is not all just a huge pump and dump scheme, which, because there's no real oversight, no insurance behind it. That's not the word I'm looking for, but there's
accountability.
Thank you. That's the word. No accountability. it's all made up. It's to me, and I apologize, Alex, but to me, crypto reminds me of Whose Line Is It Anyway? Where the numbers are all made up and the points don't matter. If you say this is going to be worth $2.5 billion today and then tomorrow it's not worth anything, that's a real thing that's happening. And I also fail to understand how any of the president of the United States actively attempting to enrich himself and his family publicly in the middle of all of this, flying to this event in Marine One, which, by the way, the food looked gross. I saw a picture. It looked gross. I fail to understand how any of this is a move in the right direction.
I don't think anyone's going to argue that it is. I really don't. Not this event, certainly. But it's just, it's indicative of the kinds of people who are attracted to this. You know, the people with dollar signs in their eyes. And I would just proceed with extreme caution if you're venturing into that world. Extreme caution. All right, moving on. I wanted to talk to you actually just for a second about something that I've been looking into recently, because you ever message somebody you haven't talked to in a while and you don't hear back from them and you wonder, do they hate you now, or, you know, did they disappear, or maybe their phone is broken, or all sorts of possibilities that seep into your head. And you don't have any information. You don't have an actual response. You can't find out. Of course, you can always call the person, but for some reason, we don't do that anymore. Waiting for an answer. How many of us have done that? Well, you've texted somebody and you don't get an answer. Well, if you do this on the app that we all know and love called Signal, which is encrypted end to end, and it's, you know, what all the cool kids use, there is a more than zero chance that the person is alive and well and does not hate you, but has not seen your message. Why is this? Because many times people stop using Signal and they go to another app. They go to another messaging app and they message people there. They might even uninstall Signal from their phone. Unless they delete their Signal account, their messages are still going to their Signal account. And they don't even know it. And you assume, you will see the two check marks that indicate that the message has been received. However, the check marks will not fill in, which indicates that the message has been read. But if they have opted to turn that particular feature off, those check marks will never fill in, because that is an option to not have people know when you've read something, which I think is tremendously intrusive right there. But this whole thing with Signal, I think it's a glaring issue, a glaring security problem. Maybe not a security problem, but just a feature problem, where if somebody changes their mind as to what they are using and they have decided at one point to use Signal and they didn't delete their account, all the people that assume they're still on Signal are being ghosted and they have no idea that that is what's happening. Have you guys ever experienced this, or did you know this was part of how Signal worked?
Oh, yeah. A member of my family tried Signal, you know, a long time ago. I had encouraged them to use it, and they did for a little while, and then decided to no longer use it and just uninstalled the app. And when you are a Signal user, the Signal basically goes to lets every other Signal user know that when we're communicating with this person, use the Signal protocol, use the Signal app, instead of plain old texting. And if you don't delete your account, Signal still thinks that you're receiving your stuff there, and doesn't let people go back to just regular texting easily. And so it is a usability nit, I guess, would be what it was called. But and it can be a pain, but it is one of those things that if you're going to stop using it, yeah, you have to delete your account. You can't just uninstall the app and expect everything to work again.
Okay, but when do they tell you that? Because nobody told me that. And, you know, I just was looking around the net, seeing if anybody else experienced this, and I found a whole lot of people have, and it's caused real problems. And my question here is, how could we fix this? What kind of feature could they install? I'm thinking something that alerts you if a message hasn't been read in a particular amount of time. But of course, that would negate the possibility of not having that feature where people know that you've read a message, which, again, I find to be intrusive. It seems like Signal has some responsibility to let people know that their message is going into a black hole, but they might not even have access to that information. So, I mean, it could be just a design flaw in the way this technology is implemented, but it's causing real problems where people think they're being ghosted and they're not, and other people aren't getting messages. And it just, it adds to the disconnect that we're all feeling, where we can't figure out how to talk to each other anymore. And it's just, this is the perfect storm right here, where you're doing the responsible thing. You're using a secure service. It's encrypted end to end. And for whatever reason, sometimes people decide they'd rather use something else. And it just feels like everyone's being punished for people making that decision. Am I being too harsh?
I don't think you're being too harsh. I think that's a reasonable thing to expect from a product like Signal. The only one thing I could think of is maybe they could institute some sort of, if Signal notices that you haven't signed in for a while, it might send you some sort of, are you still using this sort of message, or send people sending to you some sort of note that this person hasn't been seen on Signal for a while. Other apps, I know Telegram will let you know if you look up your chat with somebody when the last time is they were seen on the service. So when the last time they logged in or were using it or whatever. And I don't know if Signal does something similar, but that might be something interesting to look at.
Well, that's a good idea, Rob, actually. In fact, what Signal does, once a month, I think, they send me a reminder to enter a PIN. And I can get away with not entering it, but it'll keep nagging me. And if I enter the PIN, it'll say, okay, I'll remind you again in a month. It's somewhat annoying, but it proves that they can reach out and determine that you are still there. And yes, something like that, where if you don't answer that question, maybe send some kind of stock remark to anyone who has tried to message you in the last couple of weeks that this person may not still be using Signal. Try reaching them a different way. That would solve the problem, I think. Yes, Alex.
Perhaps what we could do is take a cue from the crypto world here.
Oh, for God's sake, Alex, let it go.
And we could mandate that all of these instant messaging applications have their kind of know your user type of requirements, where they warehouse all of this personal information and data, their driver's licenses, their home addresses.
Uh-huh. And then it all gets leaked, and the dark web has it, and all of our information is out there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, why not, right? I mean, it's already out there anyway, right? And then if somebody doesn't respond to a Signal message, we can put something in the mail to them directly, right? They've got a postcard from Signal or Telegram or something like that. I think, somebody's got to keep the postal service in play here.
Moving on. Gila, I just found out that Nolita has only been around since the late 1990s. So it is new. For me, it's new. That's recent. Nothing to say?
No, I mean, that's that's fair. It was part of a really funny How I Met Your Mother episode-long joke.
Which came out in what year?
06?
Yeah, you see. I basically, when I was a child, I memorized all of the little town names within Manhattan. And I did that once. I didn't think they would be changing them. So I guess I have to do it again.
Town names, though?
What do you call them? Neighborhoods, towns,
neighborhoods,
villages, whatnot. Go ahead, Rob.
When I was a kid, there were Italians in Little Italy, which is no longer the case, demographically speaking.
I know some who would disagree with, but regardless, we're not going to get into that right now. Okay, so you might have heard that Trump's latest thing is to stop student visas from being applied for from foreign countries. Yeah, it's part of his war on education, and Harvard in particular. I was looking at this Indian website, which basically is addressing concerned college students and the many questions they have. What are the latest restrictions all about? How does this affect me as an Indian student looking to study in America? What recourse is available? But here's a question that really leaped out at me. Can my social media accounts really be used to deny me a visa? And the answer is, it does seem so. The Trump administration made global headlines in April by canceling the student visas of hundreds of international students due to their participation in pro-Palestinian protest on campus. Some had made social media posts in favor of the Palestinian cause. American authorities have stated that students are given leave to study in America and not to engage in political activism. Several Indian students were hit by these visa cancellations. To be clear, these moves were subject to legal challenges and were subsequently reversed. However, they have established precedent as well as the general intent of the administration. And what they apparently are doing now is going well beyond that and targeting people who have even criticized the Trump administration in one of their social media accounts. But my question here, and it seems to be something that nobody is really addressing, what if you don't have a social media account? What if you say you don't have a social media account? What if you have a social media account that is in a different name and doesn't have your real info in it? All the things that we have been encouraging people to do over the years. What if you do that? You know, how do they know when you apply for a visa what your social media handle is? Where is that information stored? Unless you give it to them, it seems fairly easy that you can just decline and not be a part of that. You can also delete your social media accounts. So there's no record unless they go to, to look at the Wayback Machine or something. Any thoughts on this, Alex?
Coincidentally, I was answering some questions from a colleague, actually a former colleague of mine, who is a professor that is coming to the United States and has to apply for a visa. And he asked me about the social media disclosure policies because this individual doesn't have any social media accounts whatsoever, never believed in it, never used it, never touched social media. And so he wanted to know, well, do I need to disclose my Instant Messenger accounts? Does a Signal account or a WhatsApp account count as social media? I mean, what would you guys say? I would say no, instant messaging is not a social media account. But that raised then the issue of if you state on your application and you go for your interview and you have zero social media accounts and zero social media presence, does that in and of itself then raise a red flag to the interviewer that you might be lying or you might be holding something back? Because I think that's the outlier case these days. The people that don't have social media are, I think, by far the minority.
So you're saying that we could actually be living in a world where you're a suspect if you don't participate in this lunacy called social media?
Absolutely. And I'll give you another case study as to where, or rather an example as to where this has happened before in the past. When I had to undergo a lifestyle polygraph examination to obtain my security clearance many years ago when I worked in the intelligence community, there were certain people, myself included, that were called in for extra questioning for a separate session of the polygraph. Mine had to do with other issues, but there were a couple of people that had never used drugs before in their entire life. And on their SF-86 information, they claimed that, they've never used drugs, they've never touched marijuana, they don't do this, they don't drink, they don't have any alcohol. And these were, very, very straight-laced people that were about to join the intelligence. And because that was the outlier, they were subject to additional questioning under a polygraph, because it's somewhat unbelievable to think that nobody has ever touched alcohol or marijuana or whatever the hell it is, throughout their entire life. So, by not engaging in something, you can subject yourself to additional scrutiny.
Okay, but you're describing going into the intelligence world, going into the United States. Is it going to reach the point where they subject tourists to polygraph tests?
No, I don't think so. I think just administratively, that would be an issue. But I wouldn't be surprised, given that, when I came back into the United States, was it on Friday after being in Barcelona last week at JFK Airport, when a massive number of flights were coming in, there were literally two passport control officers working. I mean, it took, it was totally absurd. So it's just the idea of the amount of processing and additional resources it would take to examine all of these people and their social media presence. It's really no wonder to me that Trump is trying to just cancel student visas indefinitely and indiscriminately, because that just puts an end to the issue. You don't have to actually address the real consequences of your decisions at that point.
Rob, did you have something?
I was at one point in a job hunt where an interviewer reacted with incredulity when I told them that I didn't have a Facebook. I'm an enthusiastic social media user, but I've never been on that particular one. And they were like, what do you mean? Everyone has Facebook. And, you know, I'm like, I use this other stuff, but not Facebook. But my personal social media has always been very findable and connected to my, you know, my legal name, my pseudonym, my whatever. And I can also confirm that as someone who has never done drugs or tried alcohol or any of that, like, that does make you the outlier in very many situations. And it's kind of funny to think of people being considered for something like the intelligence community when they're worried about people having some sort of compromat on you, that this would be like a little too weird for them.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, though, because I just recently had a conversation with somebody where I was asking, how come I never know when there's a demonstration against whatever it is this administration has done? I find out about it after it's happened. I read about it in the papers, but, you know, I'm looking online. I can never find out. And I'm told, are you on Facebook? And I don't look at Facebook. I'm sorry. I'm not in that world. And I was told, well, you're not going to find out then. So we have actually reached the stage where we're segregating knowledge for things that people are actually interested in and saying, if you don't use the platform that Meta is running and give them your info and trust them and just dump all your privacy there, you're not going to be a part of the community that's fighting those things. It doesn't make any sense. It's so absurd. But we have to take a good look at how we get information out, how we communicate with each other. Because if we're locking people out because they don't use a particular platform or service, we are hurting ourselves. And we're hurting our society, I think. All right. Kyle, did you have something?
Well, I'm hearing so many different topics in this discussion. It's really interesting. There's many aspects to it. I'm thinking about the sort of outlier case Alex was just talking about, but that I would just say may have something to do generationally. Like, you'd have to qualify, because I think it comes in waves. There are people that grew up when and never really got into this because it didn't exist. There are people that grew up with it as a ubiquitous thing who are choosing not to use those things. So those outliers may have different reasons, and it may fluctuate. So to have it as an across-the-board rule, I think, is sort of difficult. And I also was thinking about just generally how communication is suffering in the, I guess, paradoxical or ironic nature of that. In contrast to how many different modes of communication we have. And I do think that protest thing that you're just talking about is mostly because of the need for those actions to go where people are. And that's maybe speaks volume for what I just said about communication suffering in general. If you're not actually able to connect, if you're not comfortable, people are not actually communicating openly, then it'll break down. And if those modes change and shift over time, people have to be aware, and they can't be sort of stuck or locked in or at the effect of things that aren't actually working the way they're supposed to. But I just think that it's just a huge problem in the midst of having so much ability. The cost of communicating is so much cheaper than it was when this was about telephone system. Uh-huh. And we have to sort of answer some of these questions with some thought so that we are communicating, because I really think that's vital. And I personally think that you got to just do whatever's comfortable for you. as far as what you use and what you don't, and also spread it out, or feel free to abandon things or just idle with your use of them if things change or shift. And I mean, maybe that's not for you. Maybe you don't want to subscribe to any of it.
I shouldn't have to.
Amazing over time what people do choose. I've had conversations with people that were on one thing and then didn't really start something until start using something else until some of these decentralized systems started up. So that there's different choices that people make over their time.
And I'm not going to judge them based on those choices. I mean, yeah, there are a bunch of activists I knew who used Twitter private messaging, direct messaging, mm-hmm. to plan their actions, and I didn't think that was very secure. I don't think Facebook is very secure. A lot of it seems nonsensical, but I'm not going to judge based on that. It's we all have our choices. What I'm saying is, don't lock people out because you decide to do something else, and don't shame somebody for using something if you don't use it. But stay in communication. Yes, we have so many ways now to communicate with people, and we communicated better in the 50s when we only had telephone lines. So I want to close very quickly before we go to overtime on channel 2600 on YouTube with this story about Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene getting into a spat with Grok, the Twitter AI. A user asked based on what Marjorie Taylor Greene was saying, if she could be considered a Christian. And the bot said, whether she's really a Christian is subjective, depending on personal and theological views. Her faith appears genuine to her, but public actions create controversy. Green, of course, got into an argument with the AI, saying the judgment seat belongs to God, not you as a non-human AI platform. Grok is left-leaning and continues to spread fake news and propaganda. When people give up their own discernment, stop seeking the truth, and depend on AI to analyze information, they will be lost. All right, so you and Elon just duke it out somewhere. I just will watch from the sidelines. We are out of time. You've been listening to Off the Hook here on WBAI. You can write to us, oth@2600.com, and please support WBAI by going to buddy.wbai.org and pledging whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, a small amount that you won't miss that will add up to a bigger amount every year and keep us going. We'll be back again next Wednesday, 7 p.m. here on WBAI. Again, tune in at 8 o'clock on YouTube, channel 2600, for Overtime, where you can call us and we can continue the conversation.
Now the corporation stop
pushing fossil.
In a multiple shooting
downtown at the bank.
Reluctantly the panic
begins to catch
fire, but it did not affect
the steady silent drop.
Oh, the state of his look,
it looked like Hollywood
with makeup bleeding
all over the crowd.